On behalf of the National Research Center for Value Education and Engineering, IIT Delhi, Vivekananda Study Circle, and the Wellness Club of IIT, and the Aranya Vihara Trust, I welcome the audience to this understanding. To begin the proceedings, I would like to invite Professor Rahul Garg, Head of Value Education Center, to introduce about the center and BSC and welcome the speakers.
It's a privilege to have enough speakers like you here. Let me just describe very briefly about National Resource Center for Value Education and Engineering. It was set up in 2001 with the objective of providing value-based education or value-based inputs to our engineering students at IIT Delhi, and also act as a national resource center, and its mandate was to also develop coursework for providing value-based education to engineers in the country. And since then we have come a long way. There's a lot of different types of courses and teaching styles and all that we have experimented with. Vivekananda Study Circle is a part of National Resource Center for Value Education and Engineering, where we, organize talks by people who have actively worked on these areas, and we also hold discussions with students and things like that. So these are the kind of activities that we do, and you can visit our website or visit the center for more details. And yes, we also, this is a student body wellness club that also actively works on these activities. So wellness club is a part of what is called the BRCA, Board for Student Recreation Activity. It's a club within BRCA, which looks to organize various wellness-related activities for students at IIT Delhi. So it conducts regular yoga sessions morning and evening. It conducts various meditation type of workshops on the campus. And it also organizes talks by various eminent people who are in this field. And the motto of the Wellness Club is for students to become a better version of themselves. So with that,
Thank you, Professor. It's my proud privilege to introduce you the Aranya Vihara Trust to begin with and to give you a brief introduction of today's esteemed speaker. The Aranya Vihara Trust was formed recently, of course, about a couple of years back, to make widely available the teachings of the Buddha as taught by the lineage of Venerable Ajahn Chah in the Thai forest tradition. The founders of the trust were inspired by the writings of Ajahn Sumedho, who was the first Western disciple of Ajahn Chah, and felt that lay seekers in India should have an exposure to the tradition, the teachers, and the teachings. Dhammarama, a city center of the Aranya Vihara Trust, provides facilities to hold retreats by the visiting monks and nuns, conduct workshops, and offers a place to do self-meditation and study in the library. The center is located opposite to the Dwarka Sector 11 metro station and is open daily from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. Daily group meditation happens during 6 to 7 p.m. there. Everyone is welcome to use these facilities. The trust also has keen interest in establishing a monastery of the Thai forest tradition in India in future and is making efforts in this direction. Now, about the speaker, Ajahn Jayaswaro. Ajahn Jayaswaro, whose original name was Sean Michel Chivatan, was born in the Isle of Wight, England on January the 7th, 1958. He joined the monastic community of Ajahn Sumedho, a senior monk of the Thai forest tradition, for range retreat as an anagarika in 1978. And subsequently, in the same year, he became a disciple of Ajahn Chah in one of Thailand's most, who is one of Thailand's most renowned Buddhist monks and meditation masters at the Wat Pa Pong Forest Monastery in Northeast Thailand. he took full ordination with Ajahn Chah as Upanishadvat in 1980. After the initial 5 years of monastic training, Ajahn Jayaswaru went on an extended solitary retreat before taking on teaching and administrative duties. Over the next several years, he alternated between periods of retreat and service to his monastic lineage. During this time, he was entrusted by the elders of his order with writing the official biography of his teacher, Ajahn Chah. In 1997, he assumed the position of the abbot of the Wadpa Narachand, the international monastery of Ajahn Chah's lineage, which he remained till the end of 2002. Since 2003, Ajahn Jayaswaru has been living in a hermitage at the foot of Khao Yai Mountain National Park in Thailand. The Dhamma teachings and meditation retreats he gives at regular intervals at a nearby retreat center offer inspiration to both lay people and monastics. He is also a key figure in the movement to integrate Buddhist developmental principles into the Thai education system. Many of his Dhamma talks are also broadcast on radio and television. Ajahn Jayaswaru has written many books on Buddhist themes in Thai language, a number of which have been translated into other languages, including Chinese, French, Italian, and Portuguese. His latest English work, Without and Within, is a general introduction to the Theravada Buddhist tradition. He has also written the English version of Ajahn Chah's biography, which is entitled Stillness Kolum. In 2011, Ajahn Jayaswaru was granted an honorary doctorate degree in Buddhist pedagogy by the Mahachulamgon Rajavidyalaya University in Thailand. His books and talks are available in websites and YouTube channels of the Panya Pratip Foundation, the link for which has already been circulated along with the email that announced his talk. IIT is fortunate to have Ajahn Jayaswaru with us today, also because today is his birthday. On my own personal behalf and on behalf of all of us here, I request his permission to wish him many happy returns of the day and many long years of Dhamma teachings and Dhamma practice. Now, as part of the tradition, I would like to formally request Ajahn Jayaswaru on behalf of all of us to take the stage and deliver the talk on the heart of the matter, engineering a life with meaning. Ajahn Jayaswaru.
Good evening, everyone. I'm very, very happy to be able to meet with all of you this evening. And I will begin by giving. Can everyone hear me?
Yeah.
A discourse, and then I'm still opening it up for questions, or discussion, or argument. I'm open to anything. But being an institute of learning has brought up some memories of my own education in England, and in particular an exam paper, or an exam paper that I received back from my English literature teacher. With a comment on it, which I found quite eye-opening. He said, the fact that you can pose a question which is grammatically correct doesn't mean that it has any meaning. And it's both obvious and quite intriguing statement. But it's, I think it applies to one of the most overrated questions that you're likely to hear, is that what is the meaning of life? So it sounds a really profound question, and you probably feel that you sound very profound when you ask this question, but I would propose that it's a meaningless question. It doesn't really provide any opportunity for a useful, beneficial answer. What I think is a better question is, how do we bring meaning to life? So when you say, what is the meaning of life, it's like there is something called a meaning which you can attach to this concept of a life. But in practical sense, in Buddhism, if nothing else, this particular school is especially concerned with what's practical, what works. And the question is, how can we live a life with meaning, and what does that even mean? So we are creatures, I think, who are distinguished by our need for meaning, and we are characterized by our need to create stories or narratives out of our life. We explain our lives to ourselves in terms of narratives, which in other words is giving meaning to our experience. But what is this meaning, and why is it that so much mental distress and mental illness can be traced to people having no real sense of meaning in their life? So we can put a lot of effort into something if we think it has meaning. And we can be very lazy about things that we don't see have any real meaning to our life. When you're in school, this is a question, isn't it? Cry of anguish, but what will this, how can I possibly make use of this in my life after I leave school? You know, what's the meaning of it? So, I more or less rejected the English religious tradition, Christian tradition, at a very young age. I think I was probably 7 or 8. And my father told me I should go to church because it's a good thing to do. And I went dutifully. But after a while, I kind of ran out of steam. I didn't see it didn't have any meaning for me. And I said, I don't want to go anymore. And my father said, you should go, it's good for you. So I said, well, if it's good for me, then, or it should be good for you, then why don't you go? And so he didn't have any answer to that. So that was the end of my religious education as such. But in my teens, I became very interested in the question of what's a good way to live, or what's a good life. So if you're comparing cars, let's say if you compare cars, you have a number of criteria by which you can make a decision as to which is a superior car. It might be in terms of its safety, its durability, its speed, its beauty, its design, whatever. You make distinctions and you distinguish between things, you choose between things based upon criteria. So this is my question. What are the criteria for deciding that one life is superior to another life, or is it even valid or legitimate to ask that question? You know, referring back to my English literature teacher, is this a question which is grammatically correct but is meaningless? But I felt that it was important to come to some kind of an answer. Is there some ways of living in this world that are superior to others? And how would we decide that? So I was very interested in the mind. I was very interested in questions of good and bad, and right and wrong. And there was, at that time, I guess even to this day, there's been postmodern idea that there's no meaning out there, there's no intrinsic meaning, but you make a meaning, and you create your own meaning. And as ultimately there's no, say, true meaning, every created meaning is of equal validity. That didn't really make sense to me. So my education started to diverge. There was the schoolwork, which I kept up reasonably well, and then I embarked on my own studies, which I was much more passionate about, enthusiastic about. Studied a lot of psychology and social psychology, and I think the person who came closest to a teacher for me in that period was probably Shakespeare, because he posed a lot of questions about life and good and bad and right and wrong and so on in a very compelling way. But eventually I came across the teachings of the Buddha, and for me at least, it was a sense of homecoming. I didn't feel that I discovered some exotic Asian religion, but it just seemed to be an elevated common sense, and that the teachings that the Buddha in some way articulated feelings that I already possessed but was unable to really access or to really digest or to express. And in summary, what I gained from this first exposure to Buddhism was the idea that as human beings we create an incredible amount of suffering for ourselves and for others because we don't understand the true nature of things. We don't understand the true nature of our lives. We don't understand the true nature of the world that we live in. And at the same time, we do have the inherent capacity or potential to understand and to free ourselves from this needless suffering that we create for ourselves and others. And learning to see clearly, not to adopt a number of dogmas as a kind of a stable refuge in a threatening world, but using Buddhist teachings as tools to understand oneself and to free oneself from all of those ingrained habits of suffering creation that we are all so fluent in, and sharing that understanding and helping others. Not to helping others to be free of suffering, but helping others to help themselves to be free from suffering. This for me seemed to be a life of true meaning, creating happiness and benefit for oneself, and then sharing that knowledge and understanding with others. So that was really what led me on the path to the life which I eventually adopted as a Buddhist monk. At that time I was 16, 17 years old. And the other main theme in my life for a long time had been based upon an incredible sense of attraction to India, as fascinating all things to do with India. And so after I finished high school, I took my A-levels a year early, so I was 17, and I worked for a while in a building site and factory and a warehouse, and then I set out to India. It was my dream. And local buses, local trains, but hitchhiking was my preferred mode of transport. In fact, I arrived in Delhi in December of 1975, at the age of 17, in a truck, having got a lift from just outside Amritsar. So I have very fond memories of Delhi from that time. And I eventually spent a year in India. I was on a very tight budget, 10 rupees a day for everything, food, lodging, travel, everything. So it was quite an ascetic life. But I learned so much, and I just have a great gratitude to this country. And of course, as my understanding and my interest and application to the Buddha's teachings grew, then given that the Buddha lived and spent his life in India, that made this bond I felt with India even stronger. But as many of the elder members of the audience know, you don't always marry your first love. And I returned to England eventually, and my path into monkhood led me to Thailand. And I've spent the last 40 years there, and I'm very happy, and I feel in many ways now much more Thai than an English person. My ties with England have steadily weakened, my ties with my adopted country and are steadily stronger. But coming back to this this question of meaning, I think that if you're whatever kind of life that you choose or whatever kind of life you find yourself leading, then your contentment is very much bound up with the sense of that you are doing something to have some meaning, and that the pursuit of wealth and prestige and social status and fame and so on cannot really answer that need. So it's not with saying that the unbridled pursuit of these things is evil in many ways. It's just basically unintelligent, because it's following a path which is not really able to meet the deepest needs of a human being. So this is the Buddhist hypothesis. So in Buddhism, they're not sort of telling you what you should believe. They're saying this is our hypothesis. Have a look. Try it out. What do you think? So the Buddha never criticized the pursuit of wealth and so on as such, but merely pointed out that they are adjuncts to a successful life. They are not the essence of that life. and that without a spiritual dimension to our life, then there's something missing. There's some part of us with us inside. So I'd just like to make a few comments on how I understand Buddhism, like big picture. One of the results of the hegemony of Western political, economic, cultural power over the past 100-200 years has been that a number of ideas and views and beliefs have just spread into the mainstream of Asian cultures, and they don't want to come in under the radar. Of course, there are certain things that are obvious and everybody recognizes in sort of economic models, the way we dress, maybe the music you listen to, the movies you watch, and so on. But in the ideas and the values that creep into our Asian cultures, then I think people are a lot less vigilant or a lot less aware of how that happens. I was talking today with someone and telling them how the schools I'm involved in Thailand, a common kind of cry of anguish coming from teenagers is, I'm 13 years old and I don't know what my passion is. There's this idea that you should follow your passion and follow your dream. So, now that's not an idea without merit, of course, but it is based upon certain ideas rooted in Western cultural assumptions. And when children tell me this, I say, well, I didn't have any passion when I was 13. It's not a bad thing, it's a good thing. Your passion, you're 13, it's not necessarily what it would be when you're 17 or 20. And there's a lot of studies which would support the view that if you start off and apply yourself to something at which you're reasonably competent and reasonably comfortable and reasonably interested, and you apply yourself in the correct way, that passion will arise as a result of that effort. It's not that passion always precedes the effort. So if you feel you have to wait for some passion and you feel inadequate if you don't have a passion, then I think that's not such a useful way of looking at life. So another and what I'm more interested in talking about now is the understanding of religion. And in the West, the religious traditions which are most prominent are those that grew up, religions that grew up in the Middle East. So it's like a family of religions. Judaism, Christianity, Islam, in particular. And those theistic or monotheistic religions, although they don't get on very well with each other, share books between them, but they share a basic idea of what a religion is. And that can be summarized most succinctly as a belief system. And we can observe that the word religion and the word faith these days are used interchangeably. People talk about Christian religion or Christian faith, Islamic religion, Islamic faith. And whether or not you can be considered an adherent of one of those religious belief systems is whether or not you can accept their chief dogmas. If you can, then you can be a member of that religion, and if you cannot, then you cannot. So, because the religious traditions with which the Western nations have been familiar are of a similar pattern, a similar structure, then the mistake has been made to consider all religions are basically variants of that same pattern, of that same structure. In other words, we believe in Jesus, they believe in Allah, Muhammad, you believe in Rama or Krishna, they believe in Buddha. Basically, all religions can be resolved into a choice of things that you put your faith and you believe in. And this is why Buddhism is so puzzling to people from that background. The idea, this is what a religion is. And then people come across Buddhism and it doesn't fit. So people say, therefore, it's not a religion. It's the way of life. So, you know, it's assuming that they have the right to decide what is not a religion. So I don't agree with this. I don't think there is a thing called religion, and you can make statements like religion is like this and religion is like that, and wherever religion appears it causes this, it causes that, or we need religion. And I think a more nuanced approach to religion is called for, and particularly in the case of Buddhism. So I would argue that Buddhism is not essentially a belief system, it is essentially an education system. So it's a very different idea of what a religion is or might be. So we can perhaps talk about families of religions. So Buddhism is a different family or perhaps a different species of religion. So the teachings of the Buddha begin with the human condition. And the Buddha points out that life is for ordinary people, unenlightened people, essentially unsatisfactory. And there is a reason for that. It's not a curse, it's not something that's built into our DNA, but it's because we don't understand the way things are. And wherever there is a lack of understanding, then almost inevitably there is misunderstanding. And together with that misunderstanding, there are kinds of desire which we call tanha. So Buddhism divides motivation into two kinds. You can say an ignorant and destructive motivation and an intelligent and constructive motivation. Now this point has often been misunderstood, misrepresented, or completely ignored by many non-Buddhist commentators. And you'll often hear a Buddhist that you should desire anything. You should completely kill desire. And then you think, how is that possible? Or that just sounds really kind of dreary. Why would you want to do that? And that's quite a reasonable objection, I think. But the Buddha, in fact, did not teach that. But the Buddha said that the kinds of motivation which spring naturally from misunderstanding of the nature of things inevitably cause suffering. But when we see, understand things clearly, the motivation that arises from that is to be cultivated. It's essential to a meaningful life. We can take the example of the Buddha. After his enlightenment, he spent a short period of time, number of days, weeks, just enjoying this enlightenment. And then the thought came into his mind, he proves through his own efforts that suffering, human suffering, can be completely and irrevocably transcended. So his thought is, well, if I can do it, then maybe other people can do it as well. And he had some doubts that this is so subtle and it's so profound. I'm not sure whether anyone else, frankly, can be willing to and able to realize this. And then in the traditional stories, it says the Brahma god comes down and says, Lord, there are beings with little dust in their eyes. And please teach out of compassion. So, you can choose whether or not you believe that there was a Brahma god came down, or you can consider that to be figurative language, and it was a movement within his heart. It depends how you want to translate that, interpret it. But less Buddhists, having become convinced that human beings can in fact free themselves from suffering, got up from his comfortable seat and set off to walk to Sarnath near Varanasi, some 200-300 kilometers, in order to teach his former companions and to begin the life of 45 years of ceaseless and tireless teaching until the end of his life at the age of 80. So the connection here, and this is absolutely central to Buddha's teaching, is that the Buddha was enlightened through wisdom and understanding, but that wisdom issued in compassion. And compassion was the motivating force for the remainder of the Buddha's life. But that compassion was expressed in a way that was mediated and formulated by his wisdom. In other words, he had the wish to share his insights with other people, and yet he used his wisdom to fashion teachings, to find words and images and similes and so on, which would most effectively put across his message. So there's a constant interplay between wisdom and compassion. And we can take these two qualities as being the proof of each other. In other words, if someone truly wise or just smart, then how do you know? Well, one of the ways you know if someone's truly wise is their compassion. And if you say someone truly compassionate, or they just sort of feel pity or feel sorry for people, and because that compassion will have wisdom with it, someone who's truly compassionate in a sure way, will use wisdom in order to help others. Because that kind of blind wish to help others without wisdom can be frustrating for the well-wisher themselves, but also ineffective. A lot of people burn out because they have good intentions, but they're not very wise in how they act upon them. So, in our lives, we can see that there are different kinds of motivation that we can experience. If you have this, we call wholesome motivation, which is called chanda or dhamma chanda or kusala chanda, which is separate from the craving. This is the ignorant kind of motivation, which is called tanha. Then it feels very different. So if you see someone who's had an accident, they're in pain, and you rush to there, and you want to help somebody. So the Buddha is not saying you should let go of that wish to help someone who's in pain. And said, yes, you should. It's very good that you do that. So if we look at study, research, work, then what's our motivation? So we start at the beginning on values and meaning, and it's very much concerned with our motivation. So someone is motivated by this ignorant desire for wealth and fame, prestige and so on, looks on the work itself as merely a means to an end. And when you look at work and study or your duties or responsibilities as a means to get something which you really want, then you have no true respect for your work. And if you have no true respect for your work, it's hard to have true respect for yourself. When you have no respect for your work as in itself, then it leads to all kinds of unfortunate consequences. People have no love for their work, for their responsibilities themselves, are much more likely to be corrupt. Because if you can get what you want without having to do all the tiring work, meaningless work, then why not? It leads to shabby and careless work. Because if you can just get by and still get the reward that you want, why not? So if your attention is on the quality of your work, and the quality of your study, and the quality of your research, or whatever it might be, then that is in the quality of your life, isn't it? The quality of your mind. And when you put your effort into the work itself, you're not waiting until you get your result, and you get your reward at the end of it before you can feel happy. You feel happy and contented while you're working. And it's not that you're making some kind of noble sacrifice, because you'll get the material rewards and probably more than you might do otherwise. It's not meaning, you know, just looking for a life of penury to be a good person and poor. Doing work with this love for the work itself and care and attention and respect for every single moment of your work, irrespective of the fact that some parts might be tough and some parts might be easy, but big picture, you're really committed to doing this in the best way you can. And you feel quality in your life, you feel meaning in your life. And then the money and the prestige and the name and all these things, they'll come. But they're more the icing on the cake rather than the cake itself. You know, it's not that you're not doing it for those things. So when we're talking about the meaning of life and adding meaning, life itself is a nebulous concept. What is that? I mean, all that we've got to work with is the present moment, isn't it? Right now, this is all we've got. It's all we've ever had. So, you know, if you were 10 years ago, I'd say, where are you now? You said, here. What's the time? It's now. 20 years ago, you would give the same answer. 10 years in the future, 20 years, next lifetime. You're always in the same place, here. It's always the same time. Now, this is what you've got. So if you're imagining some, sparkling future, then I'll be happy when I've got everything worked out. You know, if I just get this, and I just get that, and this, I've got it all worked out, then I'll be happy. It's not going to happen. If you're going to be happy, you're going to find some contentment and value and meaning in your life. This is it, right now. This is the time you've got to do it. So I have a I'm adopted, I have an adopted goddaughter from in Chile, and she's just started university this year, and it's tough for her, Tibetan girl from the countryside in the Chinese university, and she started this social network. She has started a little group. So there's three guardians, myself and two Chinese ladies, and we were guardians of this young girl. And she called the group For a Better Tomorrow. And so I changed the name of the group. It's called Making Today Better. You know, so you have to wait for a better tomorrow. You know, just struggle on, grit your teeth, and do it, and tomorrow will be better. So make today better. You know, you can do it. You're not going to make tomorrow better. So how do we do this? So a few minutes ago I spoke about Buddhism, at least as I understand it. Of course, there are many different views and takes on this. But my view of Buddhism is essentially an education system based on the fact that the Buddha said that a comprehensive and holistic development of our conduct, of our emotions, and of our thinking is the path that will lead to true happiness, true freedom, to wisdom, compassion, and liberation from suffering. Now, this path, you may have heard, it's referred to as the Eightfold Path, but it's very commonly reduced to three kinds of training or education. In the Pali language, this is the word sikha, S-I-K-K-H-A, and that's the root of the Thai word for education, and probably in other Indian languages, I would think. So we're talking about an education of conduct, an education of the heart, and an education of the mind or the cognitive faculties, and a clear vision. So in terms of conduct, then the tool that we use, the essential basic tool, is volition. So as human beings, this is again not an article of faith, I would say, that we have drives, we have instincts, no different from any other animal. It's need to procreate, it's need to physical survival, and so on. But what we have as human beings, I don't think that animals have this, or they do in a very, only in a very rudimentary way, is that we have the ability to stand back from these instincts and in certain circumstances not to follow them. This is quite a remarkable thing when you think about it. So you see something, maybe you walk into an empty room and you see something of some value, it looks very attractive, and you recognize, I really would like that. I've always wanted one of those. Yeah, and you feel this strong urge to take it. But I think that most of you would not take it. All of you would not take it. Why not? Well, you would say, well, it wouldn't be right. Perhaps you feel sorry for the person who's the owner, or you might believe it's bad karma. But the point I'm making is that you have this reflexive ability. That is to say, you can stop, and you can take stock, and you can make a decision. Yeah, I want this, but I won't take it. Now, I don't think that animals can do that very well, from my observation. Now, I don't think that you could teach a cat not to chase the mouse. You know, even if your technology it's probably very advanced, but I don't know whether you can communicate with cats. But let's just suppose you came up with some means of communicating with cats. You say, cat, don't chase after that mouse. Feel some compassion for it. You know, it's just like you. It doesn't want to die. I don't think even if a cat could understand, he could help himself. His cats are more as prisoners of their instincts. So for the untrained human mind, then that animal nature is very strong. But it doesn't have to be, because we have this seed, and we have this capacity which we can cultivate systematically, not to do certain things. And so in our life, in our families and in our communities, this is the basis of our morality. We start off with a problem. How can we live together? We're all people with different needs, different personalities, different vices, different weak strong points, weak points. Is it possible for us to live together in a way that every person can feel that they're flourishing, and they can feel that they're learning something, that they're growing as human beings? And the Buddhist answer is, well, let's start off with our bottom line. What is it that we need before anything else, before we can flourish in community, in families, in society? And I would say that whatever your religious, philosophical beliefs, you probably, I hope, agree that safety is number one. You need to feel safe. And if you don't feel safe in a relationship, you don't feel safe in a place, then you can pretty well say goodbye to any more profound spiritual development. Just keeping yourself alive, keeping yourself free from danger, eats up just so much energy. So we want to provide and find a way of creating environments in which everyone has that basic foundation from which they can grow. So the idea of Buddhist morality is we say, I still have a lot of anger inside me and irritation, and we say to people in our family, you know, I love you so much, but sometimes you really get on my nerves, you know, and the people who most get on your nerves, these are the people that you love the most, because they know how to press your buttons, don't they? So what you say is, you know, I do every now and again, I love you for sure, but I get angry. And you know that. But what I want you to know is, no matter how angry I get, I will never abuse you, physically or verbally. And so how do you feel if someone says that to you? Yes, it's relaxed, don't you? Because you're safe. You're not having unrealistic kind of, you know, oh, we should all love each other, we should all be kind to each other at all times. And yeah, that would be lovely, but human beings can't do that. But we can refrain from hurting each other physically and verbally. And we can do that consistently, not just for days, but for months and for years. We take what we call the five precepts, which are five commitments. You say, I take on the commitment to train my conduct by refraining from hurting and abusing others. I take on I undertake to train my conduct, to educate my conduct by not taking anything which is not given. I undertake to train my conduct, educate my conduct by not committing adultery or not betraying my spouse or my loved one. I undertake the training of conduct not to lie, to cheat. I undertake the to train my conduct, to educate my conduct by not consuming alcohol or drugs which limit or undermine my ability to keep these four promises or four commitments. So the Buddha said, if somebody makes those five commitments, takes on those five forms of education, of conduct, then he says they give the great gift, the great dana, mahadana, to all those around them. It's the greatest thing that you could possibly give your family. So precepts and, you know, morality is often versed in sort of negative terms. You know, I'm not going to do this, I don't do that. It just feels like you're missing out. Or it's like you're making all these sacrifices for what? But at the same time, if you look at it in a slightly different way from the way the Buddhists look, giving something of inestimable value to all those around you, and you're creating a meaningful life for yourself, a life in which you feel self-respect, and a life in which you feel a friend to yourself. So before you can be a true friend to others, you have to make friends with yourself. And one of the ways you make friends with yourself is through this training of conduct. When you know that whatever the temptations might be, whatever the pressures might be, that you have certain boundaries that you have taken on voluntarily, not out of fear, not out of desire, but with wisdom and understanding that this is a way to increase the quality of your own life and the life of those around you. And when you know that you can maintain those boundaries, and they're not being forced upon you, it's really important that they're voluntary. And then you find that a lot of guilt and a lot of remorse and a lot of negative mental states start to dissipate. Your mind becomes brighter. And you start to find you kind of like being with yourself a lot more. But of course, these commitments or use of volition as a tool for education is not the whole story. You can't, because the emotions and the thoughts and the beliefs and the views that underlie that kind of negative behavior, they're still there. So in the heart, training the education of the heart, then we emphasize this putting forth a different kind of effort. So one of the words that the Buddha used to refer to his teaching was, my teaching is a virya wada. So wada means like teaching. It's a teaching of effort. Teaching of the efficacy of effort. And the Buddha criticized teachings that believe that everything is due to the grace of God, or that there's sort of materialist teachings that everything is random, that they deny this very important quality that we have to make changes in our life. And if there are certain core beliefs, as Buddhists, it's not that Buddhists are without beliefs, but these are beliefs that are expected to be put to the test. And the beliefs that the Buddha says we can abandon the unwholesome and the negative qualities in our heart. We can develop wholesome virtues. We can purify our mind. So this is not a belief in something which is way beyond our capacity to put to the test. You know, something you decide take or leave it. This is something, it's about you and about your life, and saying, I can abandon, I can let go of negative mental states. I have that capacity within me. I have the capacity or the potential to cultivate patience and kindness and compassion and all these beautiful, noble virtues. There's not one that I do not have the potential to develop if I go about it in the right systematic fashion. I can purify my heart. So these are teachings that have to be put to the test, and so we know whether we have some real faith in Buddhist teachings to the extent which we're willing to put them to the test and see whether or not they're true. That's absolutely essential. So in the training of the heart, there are four kinds of effort that we learn to apply. And the first kind of effort is learning how to look after our mind in such a way that negative mental states, whether it's anger, depression, anxiety, confusion, stress, and so on, we look after our minds in such a way that they cannot enter into the mind. But of course, it's highly unlikely that you're going to have 100% success rate with that. And so that leads us on to the second kind of effort is, in the case that your mind has become invaded by or taken over by these kind of negative mental states, we need to develop skillful means to effectively reduce or eliminate those negative mental states. The third kind of effort is, given that we have this confidence and this belief that we can cultivate wholesome mental states, all these virtues, then we have to learn the means to introduce those states into the mind. And fourthly, when those virtues start to appear in the mind, we have to learn how to take care of them, to nurture them. They're like small, fragile plants. They need a lot of watering, a lot of care. And so this is essentially the education of the heart. So that education of the heart takes place throughout the whole day, throughout the whole life. But we talk about two kinds of effort, four kinds of effort, in two different phases or two different modes. So there's the formal mode and this informal mode. So the formal mode is what's generally called meditation. You're sitting with your eyes closed, or walking up and down. The essential features of the formal mode of effort and education of the heart is that you manipulate the environment to make it as conducive as possible to the work. So that would mean a place that is as quiet as possible, not too hot, not too cold, and one where you're not going to be disturbed, disrupted. So it's like if you're any kind of subtle work. If you're a scientist, you want to do it in the lab rather than on the pavement. If you're a doctor, you want to be in the operating theatre. And in the training of the heart, the most profound work can be done where you set things up in that kind of way. But you can only spend so much time, even as a monk, in those kind of conducive conditions. But certainly as a householder or as someone leading an ordinary life, much more of your life is in the second mode, which is the informal mode. But the basic pattern is still there. You have this focus in, okay, in this particular situation, what are the kinds of negative mental states that I should be aware of? So if you're driving to work, let's say you have your car, you're fortunate enough to have your own car, you're driving to work, then often you can get, maybe get angry with people who drive carelessly and drive selfishly. And so that's your spiritual goal. And how can I drive all the way to work without losing my temper with all these people who drive in this way? Or you're in a meeting. Say, okay, you're not going to sit and meditate on a mantra in a meeting. It's like with your eyes closed, you get kicked out. So what are your goals in a meeting? Well, then they might be patience, and just to be patient with meetings when people grab the microphone and start going off on a tangent, which has nothing to do with what we're supposed to be talking about. Developing listening skills, and giving the same quality of attention to people that you like and respect, as people you dislike and disrespect, as to people you like and respect. If it's your time to speak, then dealing with a whole sense of self-consciousness or wanting to be praised or afraid of being criticized. So this is all grist of the mill in spiritual life. It's like, what is the suffering right here, or what is the cause of suffering? What is the way out of suffering? So it's very, very direct. You know, it's not a matter of taking on certain beliefs as such as using the Buddha's teachings as tools. So the getting a bit over time, I want to give everyone a chance to ask questions. But the one point I would like to make is the key virtue here is mindfulness. Mindfulness means remembering everything you need to remember in any situation. So that may be holding something in mind or recalling something. But if you're in the formal meditation, it might be holding your meditation object and being awake and aware of your meditation object, not allowing it to slip out of your mind. In other circumstances, it might be bringing the appropriate knowledge that you need to bear on the challenge at hand. But as I mentioned before, our starting point is that our animal nature, if you like, is very prominent, even though we find it a little bit humiliating to acknowledge that sometimes. But the more you look at your mind, the more you realize how conditioned you are, how unaware you are, and how much less rational you are than you'd like to think. Even, I would say, all of you, I'm sure very brainy people, otherwise you wouldn't be sitting here tonight. But the irrational elements of our life are far stronger than many people realize. And often our logic is dressing. It's something that we add on afterwards. I would just like to tell you one of my favorite pieces of research. This was conducted by Professor Charles Clark in California a long time ago now. He was doing research on hypnosis. And he had a group of students around at his house. And one of the students was hypnotized and he says to the student, okay, after you come out of the hypnotic state, if I ask you if you'd like a cup of tea, I want you to go over and put up that umbrella behind the door. So the hypnotized student comes out of the state and the teacher, Professor Tark, says, how are you doing? So, would you like a cup of tea? Immediately walks over to the door, puts up the umbrella, and the professor says, why did you do that? And he said, well, as I was walking along today, you know, it seemed very cloudy and it might well rain, and I haven't got a raincoat with me, and I thought I might ask to borrow your umbrella, but I just wanted to check that it was okay. So for me, I remember the first time I read this, it was like revelation. Here was somebody who without thought, without a moment's hesitation, was able to give a completely rational and completely believable, reasonably believable reason for something which was 100% irrational. The only reason that he put up that umbrella was because he was requested to do so while he was hypnotized. So this isn't your story about hypnosis, it's a story about what an incredible organ this brain is, and how we can create reasons to justify irrational behavior at such an amazing and completely effortless rate that I would contend that we have to take our rational mind with a pinch of salt sometimes. Okay, so one more thing about mindfulness, a wonderful short summary of mindfulness. Someone without mindfulness has few choices. Someone with mindfulness has many choices. So the more mindful you are, the more you wake up in the midst of this automatic pilot kind of mode that we fall into in daily life. And the moment you wake up to what you're doing, you're awake, you're aware, then the questions arise, is this right, is this wrong? Is this in harmony with my values? Is it in conflict with my values? What are the short-term, long-term impact on the people, on myself, on my people, the people around me? All these kind of questions emerge in the mind magically when you wake up to what you're doing. And it's really important you observe this, and again, this is my hypothesis to come to the test. So much of our life is on automatic pilot. It's just too much, you know, to give that kind of attention to. But we make a lot of foolish errors, and we fall into ruts, and we become blind to things, insensitive to things, and attached to things, merely because we're just following the stream. And that with mindfulness, we're learning to wake up. And when you wake up, the wisdom faculty, which we all possess, can spring into action and actually be a refuge to us and be a, and to give us some direction in our lives. So I'm not going to go too much into the wisdom development, but this is, it begins with just basically sound thinking, you know, using the rational mind well. If you're going to use the rational mind, avoiding logical fallacies, learning how to keep the mind in a neutral mode and so on. And as scientists, I'm sure you're familiar with, what makes sound thinking and what makes faulty thinking. And that's part of wisdom development, for sure. But the and creative thinking and scientists, I think, they have to do a lot of creative thinking, and you have to come up with experiments to put hypotheses to the test. That's creative thinking, isn't it? But there's a kind of thinking beyond that, and one of the things about thinking is that you have to become familiar with the space around thinking, before thinking and after thinking, and to see thinking in context. So if thinking is just the default activity and you have to think all the time, you have to have something or other in your mind all the time, that's a kind of neurosis, and there's no peace there. So in Buddhist meditation, the goal is not to learn how to stop thinking, you just become like a insensitive smiling rock or something. You know? It's based upon the principle that we have a lot of junk in our heads. And it's like you have all this furniture in a room, far more than you can say. You have to sort of push it away to make a way through the room. So what's the rational thing to do? What do I actually need in this room? I need a sofa, I need a chair, I need a... And then get rid of the rest. Not that you don't have anything. So our minds are so cluttered. And there's a cause of unnecessary stress and strain and anxiety. And our thinking is completely... it's like a servant's taken over the house, if you like to use another analogy, if I may. So we're trying to let go of unnecessary thinking, and also when we don't need to think, just to dwell in that presence, that clarity of mind. It's not that not thinking means absence and dullness and sentience. You can experience this non-compulsive thinking and rest in it, but awake and there in it. It's just a wonderful state to come to know. It's a whole dimension of life that many people unfortunately don't ever recognize. But then you begin to notice and you begin to turn your mind to impermanence and to the process nature of phenomena. And again, I don't want to go on too much further. This one key point of Buddhist wisdom development is seeing and appreciating how in our life there are no nouns, there are only verbs. Okay? The body is a verb, it's not a noun. So as physicists or scientists, I'm sure you understand this. Your mind is a verb, it's not a noun. Thoughts, feelings, every aspect of your existence is verbs. It's a flow of phenomena. And in Buddhist wisdom development, we're moving away from this idea of things and me and him and us and them. And our group and their group, and these kind of very rigid noun, billiard ball, Newtonian view of life, and seeing things as they are, which is a flow of phenomena, and learning how to navigate that flow and to see what elements of that flow you can take some responsibility for and what elements you can't. So, I'm going to end my talk here. I could go on talking about this for a long time. And I'll just say that we're beginning a new year, 2020. And you know, in eyesight, 2020 means perfect vision. So, I would like to wish you all 2020 vision in this new coming year.
For a very enlightening talk. I think it simplified my understanding. My question is, how can I be sure that the meditation is being taught today?
That being taught today is?
The same as being taught today.
Oh, you can't. You can't be sure. You can't be sure about anything. But we do have, you know, our body and our mind, and our appreciation of negative and mental states we call kusala, akusala, wholesome, unwholesome mental states has a directly experienceable gauge of whether any activity that we are engaged in, whether it's meditation or indeed anything else, whether it's going to lead to our well-being or not. If over a reasonable length of time, some number of months, we find that negative mental states are waning, not increasing, and the positive mental states are increasing, not decreasing, then that's a good sign that you're on the right path. But when we're talking about the words of the Buddha that were transmitted from 2,500 years, and how can we be absolutely sure that there's always going to be some room for doubt, and that's all right. You know, we can live with doubt. Doubt's not a, you know, it's not a demon or an enemy. It's sometimes not really sure, but this makes sense, and we must work with this, and we see what happens. So we have traditions, and we have trustworthy people who have been practicing for long periods and they share their experience, and you listen and see who you feel trustworthy. You know, do you feel some trust, and does this person seem they know what they're talking about? And there is, that's so sometimes you do have to take things on trust, but you're constantly looking and checking. One of the very simple, you know, often people say, how do I know if I'm really developing in meditation or in this Buddhist training? And one of the best answers to this question that I received, and I teach others, is if you find that the things that make you suffer are steadily decreasing, and the things that make you happy are increasing, then you're on the right path. Yeah.
Thanks for sharing your experience, and really appreciate it. See, when we practice, I mean, there are various philosophies or various Buddhism practices are there. So during your life, you come across like the Vipassana, the Vishal Buddhism, the Egyptian Buddhism, various. So once you start practicing one, and you reach the stage, then you come and encounter another teaching also. So, we all understand that Buddha has given a very clear idea. Why there is so, and how we should encounter that. There is no single like denomination that we should know that, okay, this practice is good, or this should give the complete message of Buddha. My fracture in the society, Krishna is having something, people are having something. How ordinary, as you rightly said, this practice is for the ordinary person, as Buddha is for the ordinary person, and how an ordinary person can take all those things.
Yeah, and it's a tough one. I mean, from after the Buddha passed away, then there were Buddhist communities, monastic communities spread throughout Northeast India, in particular, and further south. And the communication in those days, of course, was very difficult. And I'm sure it's quite natural, I think, that teachers, right from that time, you teach what works for you. And you tend to emphasize those areas of the teaching which works for you, and then become, that's how traditions develop. And the diversity of traditions, I think, is often due to that you have gifted individuals who are applying themselves, and they have different gifts and different qualities and different abilities, and this kind of diversity takes place. If you look at Buddhist history in a very simplified presentation, you have like the conservatives and the liberals. Okay, so the conservatives, of which there are about 20 or 30 different groups, their view was everything that the Buddha taught is enough, what you need, and all we need to do is care for this. Look after it, practice it, share it with others. And of those groups, the only one that survived to the present day is the Theravada tradition, because it went south into Sri Lanka and was free from all the deprivations that the Buddhist communities in northern India suffered subsequently. So the liberals, these were the ones that said, you know, this is such a wonderful thing that we should share with as many people as possible, and we should go across into different countries, and we shouldn't be too attached to the external features of our religion. We should just keep the essence and be flexible with the externals. So obviously this is a lot more portable religion, and this is why what we call the Mahayana, which is, it's not a single Mahayana, it's just an umbrella term. Okay, so they moved into China and Tibet and Korea and Japan and Pakistan, Afghanistan and Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Iran, huge and very swift expansion. But the problem comes is that who decides what is the essence and what is not? And this is why you've got much more diversity in the Mahayana, and when they're willing to make compromises in order to get through to people from different cultures and backgrounds, then starting to absorb certain non-Buddhist forms and And so we find Buddhist groups in Japan, for instance, who've deviated so far from the original teaching that it's almost like a different religion altogether. So I would say that in one sense we can say this is just a natural diversity, but there are also this introduction and this evolution of the teachings, and from Theravada point of view, one of the key teachings was the Buddha picks up a handful of leaves, and he said, which is more amongst the leaves in my hand or the leaves in the forest? And the monks, of course, say, well, the leaves in the forest. And the Buddha says, well, the leaves in the forest are like all the things that I know as a Buddha, and the leaves in my hand are what I'm teaching. This is all you need. You don't need all the leaves in the forest. So it's a very pragmatic teaching. Whereas in the Mahayana tradition, the philosophical implications of the original teachings really take off. And from a Mahayana point of view, say this is like an evolution, like an increased sophistication and building upon the original teachings. From Theravada point of view, these are all the leaves in the forest of the Buddha. So you don't need those. So there is a question, well, how much is authentic, how much is not authentic, and in the end you just have to read and study and listen for a certain period of time and then make a choice. And aware that you don't know whether it's the right choice, you can't know. But you can know what happens within you. There are certain, in terms of groups and teachers, then any teacher who steadfastly ignores or refuses to mention his own or her own teachers, and it's like presenting himself as a fully formed, wise person. I don't trust someone who doesn't feel any gratitude for their teacher and their tradition. So that's one warning sign for me. If there's a lot of money involved and you're pressed for donations, or if there's some kind of personality cult around the teacher, these are like warning signs, you know, don't go close to those kind of things. So money, power, sexual shenanigans, those are the things to steer clear of. One of the things, I don't want to be sort of like a partisan Theravada monk, but one of the things that really attracted me to this form of Buddhism was the code of discipline for the Sangha. And so I've been a monk for 40 years now, and I dress in exactly the same way as I did the first day I was a monk. There's no way, I don't have a special hat, or I don't have any insignia or anything. And I have to keep all of the same rules that I did when I was, there's no kind of exceptions now you're a senior. And even if you're an arahant, like Ajahn Chah, you keep exactly the same rules. There's no exceptions. So it's not this idea of you don't have to do all that stuff now, you're enlightened, that's just for beginners. But the idea is that as a senior, or in the case of Ajahn Chah, like an arahant, you keep all of these rules as a good example. If you're Ajahn, your guru or someone, you know, he no longer has to keep all these moral rules, because then you think, wow, yeah, that's the goal. You know, I get there and I can do all this stuff, you know, and it's not a very wholesome mental state, is it? And then I think it just opens the way for so much abuse of students when you have this idea that an enlightened being is beyond moral standards. You shouldn't be judged in the way that a normal person is. Oh yeah, if he was a normal person, that would be sexual abuse, but he's not, so don't, how would you dare accuse him of that? And so there's so many spiritual communities been ravaged by these kinds of scandals because there's not this clear-cut moral code. And it's this idea that when you reach a certain level of spiritual enlightenment, you no longer need to keep all the moral codes of unenlightened people. So in my tradition, it says you need to keep them even more. So maybe you have a desire, saying, I don't need to do that anymore. I'm not attached to this. I could do that. But then you think, well, my teacher, he's far more enlightened than me, and he doesn't do it. So how can I possibly justify doing it? So that's the compassion of these great masters, the great nuns, as they do all this stuff, and they don't need to do it out of compassion for their students and for future generations as well. So I think the moral conduct of teachers and with spiritual groups, avoiding groups that are caught up in personality cults or caught up in empire building or building huge edifices and all these kinds of things. So there are those kinds. But in terms of the meditation itself, that's something we just have to give a reasonable amount of time to, and then after 6 months or a year, take stop.
Thank you, Ajahn, for that wonderful talk.
My question is a bit more loud, please. Yeah.
Hello, am I audible?
Can I speak a little bit louder?
Yeah.
Hello?
My mic is not working.
It is working. Can you pass on the other mic to me?
Hello. Okay. My question is a bit related to the last question only, but in a generic sense. So as humans, we have perceptions. These perceptions are all based on conditioning. Now, due to difference in perceptions, there could be disputes, be it at home, in relationship, business, work, the political setup, between countries. So at times, if there is a different perception, people may hesitate to voice their opinion for various reasons. They might be judged, there might be disharmony, or at times there may be even physical aggression or violence. How Buddha's wisdom can help us to reflect upon this issue? Thank you.
First of all, one of the qualities that we develop in, we emphasize development of wisdom is knowing time and place. And this is the right time, this is the right place to bring up difficult topics. So sometimes, often, maybe you're just so full of self-righteousness, or so we're right and they're wrong, and then we just want to express ourselves. But why would we do that? Surely our goal is communication, and we want to enable that person to be able to hear what we have to say. And somebody will only listen and accept what you have to say if they feel safe and if they feel a sense of respect, if the foundation of trust is there for that communication to take place. So the more sensitive something an issue is, then the more important that consideration might be, and it depends upon the values of an organization or of a family. For instance, one of the guiding principles of monastic order is what we call pavarana, which means that we announce it formally to all the members of our community, from the highest to the lowest, that I have blind spots. I have, if you see and you hear or you me acting in an inappropriate way, please speak to me about it. I am open to listening. So you make this declaration. Not everyone lives up to it, of course, but that is the guiding principle. That's the thing you sign up for, making yourself open to feedback. Now, it has to be said that In my monastic order, Thai monastic Chanda, is based upon this idea of you have hierarchy and you have this openness to feedback, and they are counterbalanced. It's the check and balance idea. But in Thailand, then the feedback sides become very weak, where the hierarchical sides become very strong. It's imbalance. And it's not it doesn't really reflect the system that Buddha established as well as it should. There's many problems in the monastic order because of that. But in general, I would say that you get a sense of whether somebody is able to hear you. You know, if you have some someone from the evangelical religion and come and tell you, you know, you're not going to change their mind with logical arguments. You know, they're not interested in changing their mind. So why worry? So it's a question of, is it worth it or not? Is there some possibility for some kind of communication or not? But, you know, I was talking about interfaith. I don't ever go to interfaith meetings. I think a complete waste of time. But one of the cliche things about interfaith is, you know, we're all talking about the same thing. We're all on the same. We're just using different words. You know, this is the kind of the template for all it. Although no, I don't think hardly anybody actually believes it in their heart of hearts. You know. But it seems to me that it's also a very arrogant assumption, you know, that you know what the ultimate goal of your religion is, and you know that theirs is the same, and that you're, I mean, what are you basing it on? It's very unscientific. It's just an idea. It's a nice thing to say. But I think that what would be a lot more practical from my point of view is, let's say you have a Buddhist and a Christian and a Muslim or a Hindu, and you say, for instance, I'm a Christian. I believe that Jesus is the only Son of God and he died for my sins. This is what I believe, but I don't actually know. It's my belief. And then the Muslim said, I believe that Muhammad is the prophet of God and so on. This is what I believe, but I don't really know. And the Buddha said, I believe that, you know, this, we've been born and died many, many lifetimes, and but I don't really know. And this, for me, is where interfaith should be working, in this humble acceptance. We don't really know what we're talking about. You know, and the problem is that religious people speak as if they know everything, that they know what it's all about. And there can never be any harmony that way. But when people are willing just to accept, yeah, this is what I've taken on faith. But for me, this is a major flaw of most religious people, is that they confuse faith and knowledge or vision. So it's a circular argument. You say, I believe. Why do you believe? I read this book and I just knew that it was true. And so that's why I believe. So you get to see, I believe because it's true. And it's true because I believe it. And that's as far as it goes for most religious people. You know, how can you, okay, you believe it, but there are 4 or 5, 6 thousand million people in the world that don't believe it. So on what grounds would a neutral observer say, you're obviously right and everyone else is wrong? If it's true, it's true because I believe it, I believe it because it's true, there's no dialogue possible. It's just going to be an endless conflict. But if you can make this distinction, is I don't really know, but I do believe it. It makes sense to me. I hear it and I feel this sense of consent. And yes, that feels right to me. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it is right. That's just how it feels to me. So Yeah, I'm looking for more humility in the religious world than there is apparent at the moment.
Yeah. Thank you so much for a very enlightening sharing. I have two questions, comments, or three clarifications. One is on the concept of intervene,
yes.
Second is, to take you back to the moment you said that you had a sense of homecoming.
Yes.
When you decided that tradition is what kind of attracts you. I worked on Himalayan Sikkim and sacred places and sacred groves. Aranya is part of the trust. So the Mahayana tradition, my PhD was exactly on these issues, the pilgrimage guide and everything. I mean, you have a sense of homecoming without even being exposed to things. And did you have a sense of conflict there? In the Himalayan tradition, Sikkim, Mahayana tradition, you have a concept of Rinpoche.
Yeah. So, do you have something similar in your traditions also? I'm kind of curious. You know, I've been exposed to the other traditions. Yes. I remember once in Bodh Gaya, and one great Rinpoche had recently passed away, and there was a big poster saying, "Please come back soon." You know, and I thought that's so different from my tradition, would say, well, we hope he doesn't ever have to come back again. So, I visit Tibet, or one Tibetan autonomous region, and I adopted a young girl from there, so I'm more familiar with Tibetan tradition. I have great respect for it. I've learned a lot from it. And, the family, a family I know, had a relation who was a great monk and Sudhwila Rinpoche, and just before he died, he said, "I will come back with the sun and the moon." And then a couple of years later, a child was born in the family. I have a photograph. And he's got a birthmark on his forehead. It's like a sun, like a crescent moon, and then a sun. And so he was, at a young age, he was taken off to the monastery. And so I don't have any problem about believing in this Rinpoche's out of compassion come back to for the benefit of all sentient beings. But it's not something that is found in the Theravada tradition. But what I like about Buddhism is, you know, we're all friends. You know, we don't feel it's not Theravada and Mahayana are in competition, or we think the Mahayanas are sort of heretics or something. It's just mutual appreciation, so, and mutual respect. But certain things, well, yeah. We don't quite see things the same way, but that's all right. Intervening, yeah, that I'm familiar with that. That again is not a part of the Pali or the Theravada tradition. We're talking about this flow of conditions and learning how that condition process works, and how it leads to suffering, and how one can transcend that. But that philosophical idea of, you know, all the different candles or reflecting each other, it's a beautiful idea, but it's not one that really fits into the path of practice that I'm following.
Someone at the back.
Yeah. Maybe we'll take the last question for me.
Yeah,
if
anyone has
the...
Okay,
two questions.
Hello?
Yes? Okay.
I can have... Thank you for your valuable speech. But you talked about mindfulness, what is right cliche and wrong cliche.
we should keep ourselves away from distress and depression of the sick. But I think to understand this, we should have an intuitive realization of what is mind. How Sutra's philosophy defines what is mind.
So what do you say? What is it? We just give like an explanation or words about it. It's more important that you pursue this question for yourself, your own experience. Otherwise, we're just in the realms of philosophy and theorizing. So, most simply, mind is knowing. It's a faculty of knowing. So it's a verb. If I say anything, see mind as a verb rather than a thing. So I like the translators of the Tibetan texts. They often translate as mental continuum. And I think that's quite a good translation. It gives that idea of flow. It's not like you have a mind. What is this mind? It's just one of these wrongly established questions. So just look and see what's going on inside. You get some sense of it. So
there's my question. Is that
the
more about why do you practice compassion on your spiritual journey? But sometimes in the corporate life, it conflicts with your duties and roles. So how do we balance your dharma in corporate life? Be trying not to be rude, but it's not possible to be compassionate all the time to the people while working.
Yes, thank you. One of the important features of the Buddhist teachings is that the virtues and qualities are not taught as entities or independent qualities, but they're seen in terms of their relationship to other associated qualities. So in this case, like, we have what we call the four Brahmaviharas, or the four positive emotions. And these are loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, it's the ability to rejoice when other people do well. So it's a direct antidote to jealousy. And then the fourth one, all these groups of teachings and virtues, they must always have one of them, usually the last one, which is a wisdom quality. And in this case, it's equanimity. So we see these four emotions as interconnected. So this is something that intervened, right? And that they are appropriate in different circumstances. So we develop loving kindness, which means wishing people well. So on a very practical level, and you know, it's not like you have to love everybody, but you have to have a sense of wishing them well. So in the case of someone who's very selfish or aggressive or enjoys inflicting pain on others, you say, well, how can I wish them well? May you be happy. You know? Then you think, well, what makes them happy is being nasty to other people. Is there a conflict there? But my answer to this would be, if you wish somebody well, then you say, may that person experience the happiness of freedom from that desire to hurt others. May, if someone's selfish, may that person experience the happiness of unselfishness. If that person's aggressive, may that person know that the happiness of letting go of that aggression. So it's like judo, you just flip it on its back. It's not that those negative objectionable qualities are stop you from developing kindness and compassion, but you see, what is the good, the happiness and the freedom that you would wish for someone afflicted by those qualities? But in seeking to help others in a practical means, there are always going to be times when you're frustrated and there's so many, you see someone who's suffering so much, you really want to help them, and you try everything and they reject you, they won't listen to them, and they're just, you know, happy to, they want to go on the way they are. So what do you do in that situation? So that's the occasion where you enter into upekkha or equanimity. So equanimity is not indifference. It's not saying, well, okay, I've tried my best and you rejected me and then you can just go your own way. But it's saying right now the causes and conditions that prevail do not allow me to help you. But I'm ready. If things change, that's like I'm in neutral gear right now. But if things change and you're open and I will go into that more active mode again. But if you lack that equanimity, you can just get discouraged and you can get full of sadness and depression. You can't do anything for this poor person. So this is the time when you just look after your own heart and just dwell in, and you're ready if the time should come to do something more active to help the person.
Should be the last question.
A long thinking. You know, I didn't get the meaning of become familiar with the speech around thinking as you see.
Okay. So, well, if you just try to meditate on your breath or something, and this is like stream of thought, okay, but then after a while, there's some gaps appear. It's not like constant thought. I mean, just for a second or a moment, there's silence in your mind, and then the thinking starts again. But as you continue, those spaces become larger, maybe even they last longer than the thinking. But if you are aware of that space between thinking, and you're just present to it, it's just a wonderful thing, and it gives you a context, a thought. So we tend to think intellectual people don't often identify with the body so strongly as they do with their mind. And you see, this is like your sense, this is who I am. You know, I'm smart. This is my identity. So this is why conventionally intelligent people with high IQ find meditation such a challenge, because you have to be willing to put down your attachment to thinking. You know, if you're in the mode of I think, therefore I am, you know, then the idea of letting go of thinking is very threatening, because it means that you disappear. You know, everything that you identify with which makes you unique to who you are is bound up with thinking. Then letting go of thinking, that's like suicide. So you have to just gradually show your mind that you can exist without thinking, and it's actually very pleasant. It's not that you're going to give up thinking, it's just you're finding a space between it. And then thoughts, and then as your mind gets calm, maybe you just get calm, and then just this thought just pops up. And then you see that, wow, that it's just a mental phenomenon. Where did that come from? You know, like a millisecond before you thought, you had no idea you were going to think that. You know, you didn't plan to think it. It just arose. And then it passed away. And so, wow, that's a whole different idea of what a thought is. You know, it's not, you say, I think this and I think that. But actually the thinking arises and then the ownership of it comes afterwards. So we add on a sense of I am thinking to the thinking. And the thinking is just part of the flow, it's rises and passes away. So you're educating or calibrating your whole relationship with your inner world and the things that go on within it by this process of close observation.
With that, I'd like to bring this program to a close with all gratitude to Yaja. And I would also be failing in my duty if I do not express my sense of gratitude to all the people that are behind this program, the staff of this hall, the people that cover the Institute of Hampers, the people, the staff of the guest house, the Hampers with the team. So, from the organizers, I would like to express my gratitude to the Army Directors, the National Association of Education Engineering, the Air Command Study Circle, and the NASA as organizers. I would also like to now, last but not least, express my gratitude to all the nice audience that took patience with listen to this wonderful evening. Outside that's from T-Shirt, I would like you to please join us at T-Shirt. Thank you.